Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lakeen. All countries face challenges like migration, terrorism, and climate change, which we note on today, Earth Day. Who is sitting at the table when those decisions are made addressing those challenges will shape the course of history. Evidence shows that having women at the table produces better and more long-lasting results. Our guest today shares the impact of gender-diversified leadership and why varied voices lead to stronger resolutions. Susan Sloan wrote about the stories of women breaking barriers in her new book titled A Seat at the Table, Women, Diplomacy, and Lessons for the World. The esteemed Milan Vavir, first U.S. Ambassador for Global Women's Issues, says the book clearly demonstrates the difference diversity and inclusion make for greater effectiveness in diplomacy and civil society. Susan works for a global nonprofit advocacy group in Washington, D.C., engaging with diplomats, government officials, community organizers, and international leaders. Susan holds a master's degree in global strategic communications from Georgetown University and graduated magna cum laude with a bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Georgia. For her book, she interviewed women diplomats, foreign ministers, and government officials. Susan Sloan, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me, Eleanor. It's a pleasure to be with you and All Together Now groupies at Progressive Radio Network. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, I saw you interview my friend Swanee Hunt, and you did a wonderful job. So I wanted to snab you here for All Together Now. So thank you for joining us. So in this book, you interviewed more than 30 ambassadors, foreign ministers, government officials. Could you tell us, how did you come up with the idea for the book, and what was the main lesson that you learned?
It was a journey. I interviewed over 30 leaders, and they came from different countries, different leadership styles: Afghanistan, Albania, Australia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, France, Hungary, Iceland, Kosovo, Kyrgyzstan, North Macedonia, Mexico, Namibia, Singapore, and of course, the US. So it was a huge undertaking. The goal was to get the voices and stories and research about women in leadership, women in diplomacy, and tell their stories from a global perspective. So having different continents represented, different regions of the world, different levels of seniority in the diplomatic ranks, and the overall perspectives and voices that we often don't get to hear. Many of these leaders that I sat down with, when I asked my five questions, said to me, "Susan, I've never been asked this before." So it really became a journey, not only about women in diplomacy, but the idea that gender diversity, parity, and equity really does bring better solutions for the world. And the journey took about 8 months to write the book. And I published last year during the pandemic. And now it's out on hardcover, audio, ebook, paperback, you name it. So it's been quite a journey. And so far, the responses have been really great. When I think about the biggest lesson that I've learned so far from writing the book, researching, interviewing these amazing leaders, is that each has embraced their authentic voice. And we're hearing so much social change, especially in the United States and around the world right now. And people are starting to share their lived experiences in a different way. And each person's authentic voice, their authentic experience, add something to the public discourse and to the table. And with each of these unique experiences, the more unique you are, the better. Versus what, 20 years ago, it may have been the message of try to be the same, try not to ruffle feathers, try to follow in someone's footsteps. And now this narrative is changing. So that's the biggest lesson and takeaway I learned from the book, is really using one's authentic voice.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, it is still true that men significantly outnumber women in this area of international relations and diplomacy. Some would ask, why is that a problem? Why does it matter? Why do we want to have a gender balance in this area?
Well, right now, we are proving why it's important to have gender parity and equity. We're in a global pandemic. So, Eleanor, we are zooming in from different places. We're on this radio discussion and from different locations. And we know that the pandemic has really hit countries so hard, and populations that have really seen issues have been women and children, especially women being out of the workforce and children being schooled at home. However, if we look at the countries who have tackled this pandemic in a positive, creative, and collaborative way, you see who the leaders are. They have one thing in common.
They're women.
Exactly. Exactly, Eleanor. So if you look at Germany, Denmark, Iceland, Finland, Norway, Taiwan, really, they became the leaders in the beginning of the pandemic, and their leadership was echoed around the world. And the reason why it was successful is that women create collaborative spaces to join together, to have different voices heard. In addition to that, there's research that has been proven that when women are around the table, more productive conversations happen. There's more openness. And MIT even states that the collective intelligence of a group rises when there are women involved in that group. And the more women, the better. And if we look from a different lens of in the profit sector for business, foreign policy research shows that companies with the highest percentage of women in management are 47% more profitable than the lowest. So bring women to the table, you'll get collaboration, you'll get a higher profit, and you'll have better solutions. And that's why women need to be at the table.
Yeah, that's terrific. So what you're saying, you know, it's not just diplomacy and international relations. We're talking about in every sector of society, and talking about business, talking about government, talking about our civil society organizations. Just having more women at the table gives you that diversity, perspective, experience, insight, and just issues that you think about that men may be less likely to think about. So I love your book. I think it's terrific. And I know you've got it in your background, but just for our listeners to see, it's A Seat at the Table. You really want to check this out, because I think what you're really doing here is recording at a pivotal moment in the history of humanity, where now we're just from the 1970s modern women's movement, women coming in to more leadership roles, actually taking over and being prime ministers in various countries, ambassadors, and just really rising up. We're not obviously at gender parity yet, but we've had a big lift, I will say, in the past 50 years. And so you're recording what that looks like, and you're talking to the women who participate in that and are helping to break those barriers. So you did focus mostly around the diplomacy area. Tell our listeners, where are we at now? Like, take ambassadors, for example. What percent of ambassadors are now women?
Well, are we talking about the U.S. or are we talking about globally?
Yeah, globally.
Either way, it doesn't matter whether U.S. or globally, we're not at parity. And if we're not at parity, then that's too few. Looking at overall leadership, when you think about where women have been and where they're going, around 70% of countries have not been led by women.
But now, that means 30% have been, which is way better than it was 50 years ago.
Right? And we're going to keep improving. But however, right, women make up less than 10% of national leaders worldwide. And one of the reasons that this book, A Seat at the Table, Women, Diplomacy, and Lessons for the World, is so important right now is that we are on the cusp of social change again. Every generation has social change. And so we're standing on the foundation that our sisters and brothers before us have created. And so much policy and legislation has happened in the United States that have gotten us to where we are. So we can't forget what's been done in the past. And now we have to take that even at lightning speed. And the reason why we have to move this and accelerate this is that right now, if we use the current rates of women in political equality or participation or economic participation, if we are stay at this current rate, it'll take us 100 years to reach political equality and 200 years to reach economic equality. Now, to me, that's a few years too long to reach equality. So by driving more voices, diverse voices at the table, especially looking at gender, we can get there faster. And a story that I want to share with you, Eleanor, and all the listeners, is that when I sat down with these different leaders, stories started coming out of why it's important to have women at the table. And I'll take this story from Croatia, the deputy chief of mission. So that's like the vice president of an embassy, second in charge. She told me that when she was on different peacekeeping missions through the Middle East and Afghanistan, she was one of very few women. She was one of very few diplomats. However, she could go in to communities where men were not allowed. She could go into the homes where women were and talk to them about the safety issues in the neighborhood, in the community, in the region. She could learn what was really going on, the issues that were plaguing them. And then she could report back on the safety and security and the issues of certain areas that men and military were not allowed to go. So when you think about how groups solve conflict, we need different types of people from different sectors solving these issues together. And so what that means is we have to have diplomats in diplomacy, we have to have military, we have to have civil society groups, and we have to have local government and local people all coming together to solve these issues, because one group alone and one gender alone is not going to solve it.
Right, exactly. And you cite some great research in there from reputable groups like the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and the Council on Foreign Relations. Study after study shows if you have women at the table, you're going to, in a conflict situation in particular, you're going to come up with an agreement quicker and you're going to have a more lasting agreement. Why? Because you've got all the voices at the table. Women are bringing up issues that men might not even think about, like what do we do about the children, and having a more fair settlement that's going to be more lasting. So it makes a lot of sense. And I find it very intriguing that you're interviewing these 30 women that are really in the forefront, like the first woman foreign minister or the first woman ambassador to the U.S. They're the ones that actually did break through these, you know, the so-called glass ceiling. What did you see in talking with them? Why do you think these women were the ones that broke those barriers?
Well, it depends the country, right? Mm-hmm. Certain countries have had ambassadors who are women to the United States way before other countries. Certain countries still haven't had women ambassadors to Washington, D.C. What I do see is that there's been a pivotal change in foreign policy, foreign relations, and foreign ministries around the world. If we look back to the United States, for instance, and the State Department, in the 1970s, there were provisions and policies holding women back. For instance, there were certain policies saying women couldn't get married if you were in the State Department. You can get married, but you can't marry another foreign service officer. If you're a woman, you can't get hard language training, such as Mandarin, Arabic. I could go on. And the issue is, if you don't have women one, allowed to have a personal life and maybe get married. And if they're working overseas, chances are there are going to be other people who are in the foreign service. So more than likely they might meet a partner who's also in the foreign service. So you're prohibiting them from having relationships within the foreign service. That's one. And then two, the language training. If you don't have women learning certain languages, you're not going to have them in certain regions of the world working in diplomacy. And so when I interviewed all these different leaders, those were the really insidious roadblocks for U.S. women getting into foreign affairs. And looking more broadly at the world, different countries that have formed more recently have used this idea and provisions to actually get women into foreign policy. I'll give you an example, Eleanor. Looking at Namibia, when Namibia was fighting for independence and became their own country, I ended up interviewing the first woman ambassador from Namibia to the United States. And Ambassador Monica Nashandi told me that it was crucial that gender equality be in the provisions of their government, their forming government, and the forming of their foreign ministry. And they eventually came up with what's called the zebra policy, where every other position is a man, woman, and then it rotates of who gets that position. And they really wanted to have that 50%, 50% equality piece. Now, some countries say, okay, it's okay to do quotas. However, you may not get qualified people coming through your doors. And so this is an issue that many organizations, whether it's a foreign ministry, government, for-profit, nonprofits, many people say quotas, they're not great. However, if we take a play from the playbook of Australia, who completely revolutionized their foreign ministry, I sat down with Ambassador Katrina Cooper. She's the current deputy head of mission at the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C., and she helped revolutionize, along with the secretary of the foreign ministry, the entire way the workforce looks like and works. For instance, they hired an outside consultant to come in and find out why there weren't women leaders rising in the ranks of leadership. There was gender parity in these incoming classes of foreign service officers. However, in supervisor, manager roles, and the top leadership of the foreign ministry, there wasn't gender parity, there wasn't equity, and there definitely wasn't equality. And so what they found was that they needed different flexible work hours, they needed different mentorship programs, and they also said, let's create targets. The secret to having significant culture change within an organization is to have 40% men, 40% women, and 20% either. That 40-40-20 breakdown will create significant culture change. And so what they did, they created these targets. They said, by this year, we're going to hit that 30%. And by this year, we're going to hit 35%. And by this year, we're going to hit 40%. Now, the first year that they had those targets, they actually didn't reach their target goal of 30%. And that was okay. They had to work on their workforce of who was applying, who they were grooming. And then when it was time to hit that 35%, they hit it. And guess what? When it was time for that 40%, they hit it in a year in advance. So targets really can work. So whether you're thinking about Namibia having policies directed at having equality in government departments, or if you're looking at Australia creating targets within their foreign ministry, there are ways to create policies to have different voices at the table and to encourage rising in the ranks of leadership.
Right. And you have mentioned a lot of the external challenges women have, because women have wanted to participate. They've just been blocked in a lot of ways. Like even when they started out in the class equal, you know, the higher up you go the chain, the more women would fall off. So you've identified exactly why that happened. The other thing that goes on, which you address somewhat in your book, which is fascinating, is there's also some internal barriers that women experience, and that self-doubt that a lot of women have, that, oh, I'm not qualified for this. And, you know, that classic case of, if there's a job opening for promotion and you need, you know, six characteristics to be it, if a woman has five, she thinks she's not qualified. If a man has one or two, he's like, this job is made for me. But so what did you learn from the women on how did they break that internal barrier of lack of confidence?
It's interesting you mentioned this, Eleanor. I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently as I've gotten this question from a few different colleagues of mine. And all of us, whether you're a man or a woman, we face self-doubt at some point in our life, at some point in our career, at some point in our personal lives. So it is with everyone. So we're not alone in this as women. However, I do believe women have a different narrative, internal narrative going on in their head that may create that barrier for them not to move forward. And you mentioned this story. It came from the ambassador of Sweden. And she said they had so many issues within their HR, within the foreign ministry, getting women to apply to these leadership roles. And she said, just like you mentioned, the women will look at 10 qualifications and say, oh, I only have eight or nine. And a man will look at it and say, oh, I have two or three. This job is for me. So exactly. And so how do we change this mindset? The first mindset to change is we think from different gender lenses. If you're a man, when you apply to a job, maybe think from a woman's lens. And if you're a woman applying to a job, maybe think from a man's lens. Would a man question whether he was qualified or not? Or would a man just throw his hat into the ring? That's one thing to do. But another thing, more broadly, is that the confidence also comes with this competence. Being prepared, knowing your topic, being excited about it. And if you are anxious, harnessing that energy and using it to propel you. Everyone gets anxiety or is a little nervous at certain times. Everyone has self-doubt. However, what stories are you telling yourself in your head? What narrative can you change? And so rather than having this self-doubt, what would you tell your best friend? You would probably encourage them. You would probably try to give them confidence. And most people, especially women, we need to be our own best friend and encourage ourselves rather giving a negative narrative. It's not worth it. And what I found from these leaders, their path to success, education, all of it was through learning and using that knowledge because they knew they had to change the world. And many of the women I interviewed told me, Susan, sometimes when you're the ambassador or the foreign minister, you don't have an option to be nervous or an option not to speak. If you don't speak, your country doesn't speak. And so we, whether we lead countries or not, we can use this guidance saying, if I don't speak, who's going to speak for me? If I don't tell this story, who's going to tell it? Larger than yourself. And I think any idea can be larger than yourself if you think about it a little bit differently, a little bit more strategically, and get out of that negative narrative right. mindset.
And as you say, be prepared. And the more experience you have, the more preparation you have, that competence can help build the confidence that really helps propel you. So I love that story. And you also talk in the book about how interviewing these women impacted you personally. I mean, not just what you learned about the whole thing about gender equality, but in what ways does interacting with and meeting with these women who kind of really stepped it up and spoke for their countries and became ambassadors and foreign ministers, how did that impact you personally?
Well, I became a fangirl of so many countries. That's one. Number two.
Okay, wait. What's your favorite country? You got to say.
All of them.
Spoken like a mother. Favorites.
All of them. I'll say it impacted me in so many different ways. One, it was a very humbling experience to hear these stories of sometimes very rough stories of women rising the ranks of leadership and what they went through. There were numerous times I was in an interview, whether it was in person or on the phone, that I would get choked up with emotion and would not even be able to speak. And sometimes on the phone line, the ambassador of Afghanistan says to me, Susan, are you still there? Because I would be so choked up from some of these moments of stories they were telling me. And what I realized is that these stories are so powerful. I'm only a conduit of sharing the stories. And it's our job as leaders, and however we lead in whatever field, is to share these stories. And personally, I started finding my own voice. When I went on this journey, this is my first book. When I went on the journey to write this book, I remember about 5-6 years ago, I was on the phone with an agent out of New York, a book agent. And the book agent said to me, you don't have the pillars for publishing. You don't have a good story. You don't have an audience. You're not famous. No one cares. And years later, here I am talking to you because I've written and published a book. It matters. People care. And leaders from around the world shared their stories with me. And now people from around the world are reading and learning and listening to these stories. So sometimes the roadblock can be someone else. But I learned from myself and from these women that oftentimes the first roadblock is ourselves. And the narrative I told myself, and this goes back to your previous question, the narrative I told myself was, oh, this agent's right. I'm never going to write and publish a book. It's never going to happen. And I kept telling myself that. And then something shifted inside of me. I think it was after I attended graduate school that, oh, I did this graduate degree. While I was working full time, I can do anything. And I was presented this opportunity to write this book. And I said, you know what? Here I am. I'm going to do it. And guess what? If only one person reads it, great. Maybe I've changed one person's mind and that they are going to help build gender parity around the world. And that became the mission, to say, you know what? What does success look like? It doesn't look like perfection. And I've been hearing this a lot lately. It looks like connection. And connection is what brings people together. And this book is bringing people together. And so that was my biggest lesson that I learned that impacted me personally, was that we each have a voice. I have a voice. And you know what, Eleanor? I'm going to use it.
And I'm so glad you did. And I'm glad you used it in writing this wonderful book that we can all learn from. That's terrific. And we can celebrate like the dramatic rise that we've seen. You can take, for example, the Foreign Service officers. You talk in the book, in 1970, there were only under 5% of women as Foreign Service officers. By 2003, that went up to 33%. So we've made progress, but we still don't have parity. You know, one third means we're not at half. And I've been, I'm sure you've been, in many of these seminars on foreign policy around Washington, D.C., and they're still very heavily male. You say there's a study showing it's 3 men to 1 woman on the panel. And I love your word, the mantles, that the men-only panel, that still, in here we are, 2021, you can still find a mantle, men-only panel. So given what we've learned from these women who have come forward and broken those barriers externally and internally, what do you think it's going to take to increase the number of women at the table to real gender parity?
This is where we have opportunity. And this is what excites me, is that we have so far to go. That means there's so much opportunity. There's a few concrete things that everyone can do. And I hope you're listening, because I'm going to tell you the few things that you can do. One, you can do what's called the panel pledge. The panel pledge came out of Australia, and now it's going around the world, and especially in Washington, D.C. What it means is the leader of your organization or you yourself take this pledge, and you can go online, Google it, panel pledge. And what it is if an organization or an event reaches out to you or your leader, your colleague, and says, oh, we'd love to have you speak as an expert on this topic. You say, okay, let me hear the demographics of the rest of the panel. And if there's not gender parity, if there's not diversity on that panel, and I don't just mean a woman as a moderator, but actually panelists, you can say, you know what, I'd love to participate. However, there doesn't seem to be gender parity. So I'm going to make a suggestion. Here's a list of women who are experts on this topic. I'd love for them to take the seat at the table. And men, you can do this as an ally. Yes, maybe you are giving away your seat. However, you are doing something far greater than you know. So doing this panel pledge, having your organization take the panel pledge. In addition to that, if your organization hosts events and has panels or speaking opportunities, who is speaking? How many people are speaking? How many people in a year are men, women? How do they identify? Are there people of color? Let's really think about this strategically. And you can ask for it. If you are sitting at a team table, and let's say you're not the whole leader of an entire organization, but you're just on a team and you're sitting there and they're talking about maybe you're in a nonprofit, who to have to honor for an award dinner, who to have on the board. Think about where you can chime in and say, hey, let's aim for gender parity here. Let's see how we can do it. And you can create your own targets. But the panel pledge is number one, the first thing to do. Another thing we can do, and I hope everyone's listening closely, you can take that 40-40-20 breakdown and build it into your organization. You also want to think about what the organization even looks like. When you walk through the hallways of an organization, what artwork, what photography, what's on around you? Are we actually creating spaces that look like the people we want to attract into the leadership mold? In addition to that, we need to think more broadly about who is mentoring and who is sponsoring. So there's a huge conversation going on now versus mentorship and sponsorship. Mentorship is great if you can mentor people, and also if you have mentors to suggest other people to be mentored by them. However, mentorship doesn't necessarily get you a job, and it doesn't necessarily give you a leadership position. And so what we need now are sponsors. We need people who are going to stick their neck out and say, you know what, Judy, Shannon, Rahal, they need to be in the leadership roles. I suggest that they apply for this job, and I'm going to sponsor them. I'm going to call the CEO and tell them, yeah, they need to be in the VP seats. So you have to think, what can you do as a sponsor, not just mentoring people, but actually showing them, opening the door for them, not just showing them the door, but opening the door. And that is going to create significant culture change. So when you think about who you're opening a door for, how many people are men, how many people are women, or however they identify, how many people are people of color, where are they coming from? And I guarantee you this, your organization will be one, more diverse, but two, will come up with better solutions and be more profitable. And so panel pledge, 40-40-20, and sponsorship. These are all things that we can do right now.
Yeah, that's terrific. I love that plan of action. I'm all for it. And I have a personal favorite there, that art on the walls, because I was in one of the first class of women at Yale. And I don't know if you saw this at Georgetown, but the walls of Yale, the dining halls, the classroom, everything was just full of all these older white men. They were all white men.
Staring back at you. Yes.
Yeah. It's like, women don't belong here. Women,
where do I fit in? Right.
Yeah, where do I fit? And they don't really want us here. It was not a welcoming environment, to say the least. But it's changing now, and we have two new residential colleges at Yale. They named one of them after a woman. So we're making some progress there.
Well, on that note, when I spoke with the ambassador from Australia, Ambassador Katrina Cooper, one of the initiatives that they did in this dismantling barriers for women, when they went through the foreign ministry, they realized that, one, most of all the photos on the historical photos in the foreign ministry were of men, and two, something very crazy, all of the conference room names were named after either men or flowers.
But not women.
Not women. Men are flowers. Can you believe that? So what they did is
even the flowers beat out the women.
However, here's the thing. When she told this to me, I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. And then I started thinking about all the conference rooms I've been in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Lincoln, Jefferson, Washington, cherry blossom. And I realized, you're right, it's men and flowers. So something they did is they changed the names of conference rooms from flowers to women leaders that have been prominent in foreign policy for Australia. They also put a photo and a bio of why a conference room was named after that person. So here, storytelling. Why are we naming certain buildings after certain people? What is the story behind it? Is there gender parity in the naming of buildings and institutions? So now I think people are thinking about this differently. Not only gender parity, but also, do we have people of color being named for buildings? So it's multiple levels, gender, diversity, multiple levels of inclusion. In addition to that, when you think about Eleanor being in the hallways of Yale and seeing all these white men staring back at you, how do we create hallways that people see themselves so they can see how they rise in the ranks of leadership? And many of the women I interviewed told me this, Susan, there wasn't anyone to look up to or look at because there weren't any women there. So we didn't have an option but to keep going. And it was some countries like Iceland and a few other countries had women who became presidents and prime ministers. And so there were a few different countries who had leaders to look up to, but many countries didn't and many women didn't. And so now as we get more women to the table, more women in leadership positions, there's other young girls and women saying, I see that they're doing this. I can do this too. And so it's a ripple effect. It's all of us doing it together. So I challenge everyone who's listening, when you go back to your offices, which hopefully will be sometime in the next year, who knows? When you go back into your offices, look around at the photographs and the artwork. Who is represented in your hallways? And who needs to be represented? And how can you change that?
Right. Very good. And I appreciate that you include the men in there. And even when you talked about the panel pledge, which I think is fantastic, I'm taking the panel pledge. I think it's so important that when there are these panels, someone pay attention. I think a lot of times it's not that men are trying to cut women out. It's that men think of people like themselves or their friends, and they kind of have their go-to group. Maybe they play poker with them. Maybe they drink with them. And they just don't think about the women. They may not even notice there aren't women there.
It's unintentional non-noticing.
Right. Unintentional non-noticing. The women are invisible. So it's bringing that awareness in. And I would have thought by now everybody would get it. But even good men don't think of it all the time. It's much better than it was, but we're still not there. And I loved in the book, you talked about the men who were helpful to you in arranging the interviews. And I know it was the men at Yale that insisted on bringing women in as students. And it's often the men can be the champions in a way. I mean, obviously we women have to stand up for ourselves and not count on Prince Charming to come save us and bring gender parity. But at the same time, we welcome the men who are aware and sensitive and care, and they're taking steps to try to promote the women and promote gender parity. Can you talk a little bit specifically, like, a man who may be listening, or a woman who is, you know, could tell her boyfriend or partner or brother or father or whatever, they want to be helpful. What can the men do to help?
Well, first, gender parity means both at the table, right? So we're not saying the table needs to be all women. We're not saying every organization needs to have all leaders to be women. That's not what we're saying here. What we're saying is both. Men and women working together bring different skill sets, bring different experiences. And that's why we come up with better solutions, because we're working together. And so it's not one or the other. So it's of no fault of anyone's of this idea that, oh, there should be more people here, more people here. No, that's not what it is. And so men, if you're listening, women, if you're listening, here are some things you can do. You can do what's called the echo. When there is someone at the table who is different than everyone else, maybe they're a different race, religion, color, ethnicity, gender, and they say an idea, echo them. Don't let it be brushed and swept under the rug. What you can do is say, great idea, Chenille. Say that again for the group. Let's hear you again about that. I love that idea. Echo them. And especially when a man does that for a woman, it can highlight the conversation. It can highlight the point. I heard from many of the women I interviewed, many of the ambassadors, saying even now that they're ambassadors, they'll be with a group of the highest level diplomats of their land in the United States, and they'll say an idea, it'll get passed over, and then a male ambassador will say it a few minutes later, and they'll all be like, oh, ambassador, that's a great point. And it still happens, even if you are at the highest ranks of leadership. So if you're around the table, no matter what level of leadership you are, you can echo people. Another thing you can think about, who is literally sitting around the table? Maybe it's who is literally on the Zoom meeting, whose video is on, whose video is off, who has airtime and speaking time, who doesn't, and how can you get other people into the conversation? And that's the whole point of looking at how to get other voices, looking at gender, looking at diversity, into the conversation. So many people right now are looking at hiring practices. They're looking at how they're asking certain questions. And also you can look at what are the experiences and qualifications, basically the merit that you're hiring for. And this story comes out of Denmark. When I sat down with the ambassador, she told me that when she got to the senior level of leadership within the foreign ministry, they were sitting around a table divvying up ambassadorial postings around the globe for Denmark. And a name would come up and they'd say, oh, and he has these qualifications and he's an expert here. And so, oh, that's a good idea. Okay, he should be posted as ambassador here. Oh, and he does this and he does that and he's an expert here. He should be posted here. Oh, she's a good candidate, but she's not an expert in Russian, blah, blah, blah. So she shouldn't have it. Let's give it to the man because he's an expert in Russian, blah, blah, blah. And she realized there was this trend going on that all of the ambassadorial postings were going to men. And so she stopped the group and said, guys, and there were only a few women around that table, it seems we're only posting men as ambassadors. Are these women not qualified, or what's the issue? And they're like, well, the merit system says they have to be an expert here, here, and here. But she said, why aren't we looking at leadership and management? When you look at that and add it into the equation, it changes the conversation. We should be looking at multiple factors, multiple qualifications, multiple skill sets, not just one vision of thinking. And she said, looking back, who created the merit? Who created how to get on the playing field? It was centuries ago, old white men. Mm-hmm. So the playing field, the system has to change. In order to get different players on the field, we have to change how we make the team. So each organization, company, foreign ministry, government, wherever you sit, wherever you work, wherever you retired from, we have to change the system itself to allow for a new generation to come in. And the old system is not going to work, so we need to edit it.
Right. And may I say, with the heavy reliance on all the men across the country, around the world, they've gotten us in quite a mess here with climate change and wars. And it's like, really, now we need to really change the perspective of how we look at these, how we solve these problems. We need to have it. And I saw a quote the other day, which I'm going to use somewhere, but it was from a man. And he said, thank God women are only asking for equality. Because if women wanted revenge, we would be done in. It's like, but yes to equality, you know, it's like two wings on the bird. You want to be able to fly. You need the men and the women. And I love that inclusive. Now, we've noticed some of these countries are doing much better than other countries. And of course, Scandinavian countries are always at the top whenever you're talking about gender equality. Our friends in Iceland, I had the great joy of speaking at the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in Iceland. They had all the Scandinavian women meet in Reykjavik, and they invited me to speak at their conference. And I met, by the way, I had dinner with the first woman ever elected to any country in the world as the head of state. And she was sitting next to me at dinner. I'm fantastic. Like, oh my God, I was just so thrilled. And I had across for me at dinner table was Prime Minister Gro Brundtland, who's the first prime minister in Norway. And it was just like, I was so honored and thrilled to be there. But these Scandinavian women are on it. And those of us in the United States who think that we're at the forefront of women's rights, I said, maybe that was true in the 1970s. It's no longer true. These women in Scandinavia really taken it to the nth degree. Can you talk a little bit, what did you find out? And you mentioned Sweden in 2014 announced they were now have feminist foreign policy. I'm like, okay, I got to know, what is feminist foreign policy? How do we do that?
Well, so many questions wrapped into one. I'll start with this first idea. When we look at equality and equity, they're actually very different. So equality is this idea that we're going to give everyone the exact same resources. I don't know if that works. Equity, however, that's different. Equity involves distributing resources based on the needs of the recipients. So men and women, people of color, we may need different things. And so we should really be looking at equity. And so that's the first thing. The second thing, looking at Scandinavian Nordic countries that have had a high number of women in leadership roles, they all have something in common. The country has amazing family leave policies, comprehensive, and they have childcare. So when we look at family leave policies, whether you decide to have children or not, whether you have siblings, cousins, parents, there will be a time in your life where you're going to need to take leave. Now, if you have children, maybe it's a little bit longer than maybe an ailing family member. However, what I found out is that having this time of family leave and parental leave, especially when families have children, significantly increases the likelihood of women being able to continue their career and rise in the ranks of leadership. I'll tell you why. If you have both men and women taking off the same amount of time, 6 months, 9 months to a year, they'll each be considered for promotions equally. It takes out the discrimination. Also, in Sweden and in Finland and in Iceland, it's frowned upon if you don't take the leave. If a man is married and his spouse, his partner, has a child and he doesn't take leave, it's frowned upon. It's like, you don't take leave? So it's culturally unacceptable not to take the leave. In the United States, we're nowhere near this.
We don't even have leave for women.
We don't. And guess what? Everybody's got a mother. Everybody on this earth was born from a mother. And we need to give that adequate time to these women. In addition to that, there's another conversation going on about leave time when a woman has a miscarriage. So thinking about that, and countries like India and New Zealand have different policies now that have helped women who have miscarriages to take time off work rather than having to be put right back into their job after a traumatic and physical situation has happened. So looking at these different policies, what government policies do we need to change? And it's family leave, parental leave for both men and women, equal amounts of time, and more than 3 weeks. Let's be real. How long did it take to make the baby? Usually 9 months. So it should be at least that. And then secondly, when people enter the work back to the workforce, who is taking care of the children? Do we have affordable childcare? And this is really affecting lower income women, single parents. This is who it's for. And we have to have a nation of workers and protected and supported families. So that is crucial. And other countries are doing it. I believe we can too. We're going to need to change a lot of things though.
We're going to need to change the members of Congress. It's the biggest thing we need to change who's sitting in the state legislatures also. So right there, that was like, I was just participating in this great conference of women in the Mideast and North Africa talking about this whole idea of women for women's rights, women for peace and security in that very troubled region. Like, how can we deal with that? It was absolutely fascinating. The key thing they came up with is more women in decision-making positions, more women at the table for peace, more women at the table for building civil society. You do that and a lot of the problems get nipped in the bud and solved right there. So that is really cool. By the way, when I was in Iceland with all these women from Scandinavia, I was like, okay, look, I have to now go back to the United States. And we are so far behind you guys in this issue of women's equity. Like, what do you think is the most important thing that helped you in Scandinavia get women to the place they're at in your country? And they all said the same thing. It's what you just said. It's the family leave and childcare. Once you get the family leave and childcare, that freed up women. They were on more equal footing in business or in government or in academia. They were more able to participate in the workforce. They were more free to take that promotion. They were more able to travel if that was part of the work. They were more able to engage civically, participate in the community, run for office, work on a campaign. All of it became possible when women and families had the family leave and childcare. So, yes. Just like strategically in the 19th century, the women's movement focused on the right to vote strategically is the most important, which was right, because they thought if we could get political power, we can get other things. Now, I think strategically our key thing, of course, get women into decision-making positions, but also family leave and childcare, absolutely critical. So I'm so glad you said that.
And you mentioned feminist foreign policy. So yeah. Looking at the rights, representation, and resources, those three things are crucial. And so all countries can take this stance if they want. Looking at a feminist lens of rights, representation, and resources. So rights, what kind of rights are we giving? Are they equitable between men and women? Resources, are we giving the resources that women and young girls need? And then representation, do we have everyone at the table? Do we have enough women being represented to talk about the issues that are affecting them and to get policy and legislation that will help change the world, like family leave, like childcare? So feminist foreign policy, the three R's, rights, representation, and resources, that is going to create significant culture change.
I love that. Sign me up for the feminist foreign policy. And by the way, that should be our domestic policy too.
You're here.
Yes. So we just have a couple of minutes left. And I'm curious to know, you did all these amazing interviews with these incredible women. Which interview moved you the most personally?
Ooh, there were a few. Mm-hmm. I hate to just choose one, Eleanor.
Okay, say two.
I'll say every interview had one, at least one pivotal moment where mm-hmm. it was this moment of connection. And there's like three stories right now that are coming to mind that I'm like, oh, I want to tell all three stories, but I know we're so close to the end. So everyone listening, you gotta read or listen to the book to hear the rest of the stories. But if I think to the ambassador of Afghanistan, Roya mm-hmm. Rahmani, her story is very moving. In addition to the issues that are facing the Afghan people, especially right now, are so relevant, and her solutions and what that can look like, very memorable. And even interviewing the representative from Kurdistan, her story, her father being killed in a terrorist attack, her being a journalist and then getting into government and foreign policy and what she's trying to do. She is an ambassador without a nation. Mm-hmm. She has no country. These stories resonated with me. They resonate with all of us. And what it means to have a seat at the table, and what I've gotten some direct messages on Twitter and on Instagram and even in my email inbox saying this needs to be required reading for not only folks in foreign policy, like the State Department officials, but also academically, that if we don't tell these stories, if we don't share this research, how are people going to know? How are we going to create change if we don't know our history? So I challenge you, if you get a chance to read or listen to the book, find me on LinkedIn, go to my website, susansloan.com, get in touch with me, let me know what you think, and also let me know who you're going to share these stories with. Because right now, some of these stories I shared with you today, they are now your stories, and you have to share them too, because that is what is going to create ripple effects and bring gender parity around the table.
Fantastic. So listeners, make sure you get a hold of this book, A Seat at the Table by Susan Sloan. It's fascinating reading and really important to know about. So that's all the time we have. Susan Sloan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. And thank you to the Progressive Radio Voices and Network. And Eleanor, you're fantastic. Thank you again.
Thank you. Listeners, in case you missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.